Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ana Mateo and John Russell. Later, you will learn about America in the 1930s from our ongoing history series, Making of a Nation. But first, Mario Ritter Jr. presents the Higher Education Report.
The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, said school closings to stop the spread of the new coronavirus affected more than 290 million students around the world. Audrey Azoulay is UNESCO's Director General. She warned that the global scale and speed of the current educational disruption is unparalleled and, if prolonged, could threaten the right to education. Just weeks earlier, China was the only country requiring schools to close. Now, students are out of school in Japan, Iran, North Korea, Italy, Lebanon, and Mongolia. Schools in parts of Vietnam, Thailand, France, Germany, South Korea, and the United States have also been closed. As of March 4th, the organization said 22 countries have announced or started school closings to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus. UNESCO, Azoulay said, is working with countries to assure the continuity of learning for all. And the organization will call an emergency meeting of education ministers on March 10th to share ideas on how to continue learning and make sure all children are included in the plans. The organization is helping countries affected by the closings to set up large-scale distance learning programs. It suggests free software that the schools and teachers can use to reach learners. However, school closings can cause several problems. The biggest one is less time spent learning. Another is that parents need to divide their time between work and childcare and may lose income. Families who are already struggling cannot always help their children with home learning as can those who have a better economic situation. In China, teachers came back to work after the Lunar New Year holiday to learn they would have to teach online. For some, it was the first time they had to do that. Mr. Li in Chengdu teaches English to public high school students. He said he is teaching mostly grammar or vocabulary because it's not convenient for students to read, because some of them have a computer. Some of them just have phones. Li added that some students had gone to homes in the countryside without their textbooks. He said the local school district coached teachers on how to use software for online teaching. They asked teachers not to introduce new material they had planned for the school term. At the beginning, the students seemed quite interested, he said. Recently, I get the data, so it's not quite good, and some of them just stay in the class for a few minutes, and some students, they miss the classes. Students can ask questions when they are online, but, Lee said, they do not because they are afraid to speak. In a classroom, he can pull out a student to speak privately or provide extra instruction. But that is not always easy to do online. Lee said that he has learned to cherish in-school communication with students and will provide more chances to do that when they return. Until they do, Lee said, it's a challenge for them to become more independent. Liam Duffy, a university professor in Wenzhou, has also been teaching online for 2 weeks. His students use the VoiceThread app on Blackboard to upload videos instead of giving presentations in class. Duffy said, even somebody who was shy and might not have spoken up in class is going to get their chance. They have to kind of be out there on a platform. A quiet student wouldn't even be facing their classmates, and now they are facing the whole class. He observed that it's the same deal as on campus in some ways. One student just made a recommendation about another teacher at the university. So there is still that sort of campus community. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. People who believe in luck and bad luck. That is to say, those considered superstitious may think that some days or events are unlucky. In the United States, Friday the 13th is known as an unlucky day by superstitious people. Another famously unlucky day for some is March 15th, also known as the Ides of March. The Ides of March is so unlucky that it is often spoken as a warning. Beware the Ides of March. First, what exactly is an Ides? The Latin root of Ides, a singular word, means to divide. So, the Ides of any month falls in its middle. The Roman calendar set Ides on the 15th in March, May, July, and October, or on the 13th in the other months. The Ides of a month usually falls on the first day of a full moon. In Roman times, the Ides of March was known as a date for paying off debts. But this connection was quickly lost because of different timing between calendar months and changes in the moon's appearance. The Ides of March was also a time people celebrated Mars, the god of war. But why do some people still use the expression "Beware of the Ides of March"? Why do they consider it an unlucky day? March 15th was very unlucky for one man a very long time ago. On that date, in the year 44 BC, Julius Caesar was killed. The British playwright William Shakespeare takes this incident from Roman history and freezes it forever in literature. In Act 1, Scene 2 of Julius Caesar, Shakespeare writes about a meeting between the dictator and a soothsayer, someone who can predict the future. "Beware the Ides of March," says the soothsayer.
Caesar asks, "What man is that?"
And Brutus, Caesar's loyal friend, answers, "A soothsayer says to beware the Ides of March."
Caesar does not listen to the warning. He should have. In Act 3, Scene 1, Shakespeare's famous line seems to show that Caesar is asking for trouble.
Caesar says to the soothsayer, "The Ides of March are come."
The soothsayer answers, "Aye, Caesar, but not gone."
Caesar's friend Brutus will be among the attackers who kill him on the Ides of March.
When he sees that Brutus has turned against him, he says,
"A too, Brutus? This means, you too, Brutus?"
This expression is widely used in Western culture when someone is betrayed by a friend. The Ides of March is also the name of a U.S. film made in 2011. George Clooney directed the film. He also stars in it as a promising presidential candidate. While no one gets assassinated, The Ides of March is a film about a friend being disloyal to a friend in the world of politics. Often in politics, loyalty and friendship do not go hand in hand. Julius Caesar learned this the hard way on The Ides of March. I'm Anna Mateo, thanking Christopher Jones Cruz for playing Julius Caesar and Jonathan Evans for playing Brutus.
A new study says up to one half of the world's sandy beaches could disappear by 2100 because of climate change. Australia, Canada, Chile, Mexico, China, and the United States would be among the hardest hit, the research shows. The study was published in the journal Nature Climate Change. Michalis Foustoukas was the lead investigator. Touristic areas, which have sandy beaches as their main selling point, will probably face strong consequences, he said. Aside from economic value, beaches play an important environmental role. Sandy beaches are important habitats supporting a wide range of species. They also protect the coast from the effects of storms, so without sandy beaches, other inland environments can be affected by the effects of waves and saltwater intrusion, Foustoukas added. Global sea levels have increased in recent decades. Major causes include melting glaciers and thermal expansion. Thermal expansion is the reaction of matter to increases in temperature. Water expands as it warms. Researchers examined satellite images showing shoreline changes during the past 30 years. They then used these trends in two different climate change situations. One situation predicted a small reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. The other situation predicted high greenhouse gas emissions. greenhouse gas emissions have a link to climate change. By 2050, the researchers projected beach losses of between 13 and 15%. By 2100, the projected losses are from 35 to 49.5%, or 95,061 to 131,745 kilometers of beaches. Australia would lose more sandy shoreline than any other country, with 14,849 kilometers projected to be gone by 2100. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue to discuss the events of the 1930s and American foreign policy during that time. For much of its history, the United States was not involved in world disputes. Only in the 20th century did it become a powerful and influential nation. President Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to see America as a great power. A few years later, President Woodrow Wilson wanted the United States to become more involved in the world. Many Americans disagreed. They wanted to stay out of international conflicts. The presidents after Wilson stayed informed about world events, but they were much less willing to involve the United States than Roosevelt or Wilson had been. The Great Economic Depression that began in 1929 reduced Americans' interest in the world even more. Now, here are Doug Johnson and Shirley Griffith.
Franklin Roosevelt became president in 1933. Franklin Roosevelt was not like most Americans. He knew the international situation well from his own experience. Like Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, he wanted to expand America's foreign policies. The terrible crisis of the Depression, however, forced him to spend most of his time on national economic issues. He was able to deal with international issues only very slowly. One of his most important first efforts was to improve relations with Latin American nations.
30 years earlier, President Theodore Roosevelt said the United States had the right to intervene in Latin America. In the years that followed, the United States sent troops to several Latin American countries. Many political leaders in the area accused the United States of treating them like children. Leaders throughout Latin America criticized the United States bitterly at a conference in 1928. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, he promised to treat Latin American nations as friends. He called this his good neighbor policy.
I would dedicate this nation to the policy of the good neighbor, the neighbor who resolutely respects himself and because he does so, respects the rights of others. The neighbor who respects his obligations and respects the sanctity of his agreements in and with a world of neighbors.
Roosevelt's new policy had an unfriendly beginning. His administration refused to recognize a government in Cuba that opposed the United States. Instead, it helped bring to power a new government that showed more support for the United States. After that, however, President Roosevelt was able to prove that he wanted to improve relations with the countries of Latin America. For example, his administration speeded up plans to withdraw American troops from Haiti. It rejected old treaties that gave the United States the right to intervene in Cuba. It recognized a revolutionary government in El Salvador. It recognized the right of Panama to help operate and protect the Panama Canal. And it helped establish the Export-Import Bank to increase trade throughout the Americas.
All of these actions did much to improve the opinion of Latin American leaders about the United States. However, the most important test of Franklin Roosevelt's new policies was in Mexico. The Mexican government seized control of oil companies owned by investors in the United States. A number of influential Americans wanted the president to take strong action. He refused. He only agreed to urge the Mexican government to pay American investors for the value of the oil companies.
As United States relations with Latin America improved, its relations with Britain got worse. Britain blamed Franklin Roosevelt for the failure of an international economic conference in 1933. It also felt the United States Congress was unwilling to take a strong position against international aggression by other nations. Some British leaders had so little faith in Roosevelt that they proposed seeking cooperation with Japan instead of the United States. New leaders in Japan, however, soon ended this possibility. They presented Britain with such strong military demands that the British government gave up any idea of cooperation with Japan.
One big question in American foreign policy in the 1930s concerned the Soviet Union. The United States had refused to recognize the government in Moscow after the Bolsheviks took control in 1917. Yet Franklin Roosevelt saw the Soviet Union as a possible ally if growing tensions in Europe and Asia burst into war. For this reason, he held talks in Washington with a top Soviet official. In 1933, he officially recognized the Soviet government.
President Roosevelt hoped recognition would lead to better relations. But the United States and the Soviet Union did not trust each other. They immediately began arguing about many issues. Within 2 years, the American ambassador to Moscow urged President Roosevelt to cut diplomatic relations with the Soviets. Roosevelt refused. Relations between the two countries became even worse. Yet Roosevelt believed it was better to continue relations in case of an emergency. That emergency, World War II, was just a few years away.
Economic issues played an important part in American foreign policy during the early 1930s. In 1933, a major international economic conference was held in London. France and Italy led a movement to link the value of every nation's money to the price of gold. American delegates to the conference rejected the idea. They argued that it would slow America's recovery from the Great Depression. As a result, the London conference failed. Although President Roosevelt opposed linking the value of the American dollar to the price of gold, he did not oppose international trade. During the 1930s, his administration negotiated new trade agreements with more than 20 countries.
The 1930s saw major political changes in Asia and Europe. President Roosevelt watched these developments with great interest. In Japan, military leaders gained control of the government. Their goal was to make Japan Asia's leading power. In Italy, the government was headed by fascist Benito Mussolini. Another fascist, Francisco Franco, seized power in Spain. And most important, Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party increased their strength in Germany. Franklin Roosevelt understood much sooner than most Western leaders the threat that these new leaders represented.
Most Americans shared Roosevelt's dislike for the new fascist movements. However, Americans felt another emotion much more strongly. It was their desire to stay out of war. World War I had just ended 15 years earlier. It was still fresh in the minds of many Americans. A majority of the population opposed any policy that could involve the United States in another bloody conflict.
A public opinion study was made in 1937. The study showed that 71% of Americans believed it had been a mistake for the United States to fight in World War I. So President Roosevelt was not surprised when Congress passed a law ordering the administration to remain neutral in any foreign conflict. Congress also refused an administration proposal that the United States join the World Court. Franklin Roosevelt shared the hope that the United States would stay out of foreign conflicts. However, Adolf Hitler and other fascists continued to grow more powerful. The situation forced Americans to begin to consider the need for military strength.
Americans did not want to become involved in another world war. They called on President Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan would force Americans to choose between their desire for democracy and their desire for peace.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. And find more stories, quizzes, and English learning activities, including videos and lessons, on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Thank you for listening to The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.